Every Christian has a Bible that they read. Some are more used than others. Some are quite beat up. Some have Bibles that have been used so often they have pages falling out of them. A friend of mine saw me with my Bible that I took on hospital visits, which was probably about 10 or 15 years old. And he said, you know, it's probably time you get another Bible for visits. And he bought me this Bible for me to take on visits, which I was very appreciative of. My sister, who is a pastor outside of Chicago, owns the Bible of my great-grandmother, who was a Church of the Nazarene lay minister to Seneca Indians near Warren, Pennsylvania, and it has her handwritten notes in the margins. And every Christian has a mental Bible as well. And that's the Bible that we actually are most familiar with. It's the Bible that we actually use. When I say Psalm 23, you say, oh, I know that. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. When I say, let's all recite the Lord's Prayer, you know what that means, and we begin. But it gets a little tricky, because what happens if I say Psalm 141? Your mind doesn't go immediately to a verse, does it? Psalm 141, verse 1. I'm not exactly sure I can do that one. Or, what does Paul say about Jesus in his letter to the Philippians? I'm not real sure. That's not in the mental Bible. That I'm going to have to look that up. And then there's parts of the Bible, the mental Bible, that we sort of know, but we just don't know what to do with. And I would propose to you that Matthew 28 is just one of these types of passage. We're sort of aware of it. It's in the mental case. It's in the mental bookshelf someplace. But we're not real sure what we're supposed to do with it. Specifically, Jesus saying to the disciples, "All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Therefore, go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, and teaching them to obey everything I have commanded you. And surely I am with you always until the end of the age." If you are like most Christians throughout history, you've probably found a way to interpret this passage as not really referring to me. This is a guilt-making kind of passage. You know, you read that and you think, oh yeah, that's a passage for going out and evangelizing and converting people, and I ain't going to do that. That's not my kind of thing. This must refer to somebody else. You see, when it says, go to all nations, right? That's why I give money to missionaries. That way I don't have to do it. I can give money to somebody to go overseas and then to convert people who live in Vietnam or in China or in Western Europe or in Finland or Norway or Mexico or San Salvador. And then when Jesus commands us to baptize, well, that's what we pay the pastors to do. That's what the clergy are supposed to do. And teaching them to obey every command, well, that's why we have Sunday school and vacation Bible school and Bible study. And we pay a Christian education coordinator to do that. And I did my Sunday school teaching 30 years ago. And that's not really a call for me. And then we move on to something else. We move past this verse and we forget about it. It drops sort of out of the mental Bible and goes away. We don't like to think of ourselves as being addressed by Jesus here as evangelists or missionaries. Partly, there's good reason for that. Partly because there's a bad reputation that some door-knocking evangelist gets about being in your face, about not taking no for an answer, about being really, really, really pushy. And we don't feel that that's exactly the best way for us to do this. But more than that, I would propose to you, We don't even know how we would do it. I think it's sort of a thing that we feel like totally in over our head. How would I stand on somebody's doorstep and actually talk to them about Jesus in a way that would be intelligent? How can I stand on somebody's doorstep and talk to them about the Lord of my life in a way that I wouldn't fumble over my words, in a way that would be confident? I just don't know how, Jesus, to make disciples. I know how to make lemonade. I know how to make iced tea. I know how to change a tire. But how do you make disciples? What do you even start? How do you even start? If somebody challenged you to go and make 3 disciples of Jesus by next month, would you even know what the first step would be to do that? Would you even have any idea? So, because we're uncomfortable with this passage, we take Matthew 28 out of our mental Bible with very careful tweezers, and then we send it away, and it troubles us no more. This passage is called the Great Commission. It's Jesus' commission for the church to go out. The commission that Jesus gives us, the Great Commission. And it's one of 2 greats in Matthew's gospel. You may remember back in Matthew chapter 22 when the Pharisees asked Jesus which of the commandments in the law was the greatest. And Jesus says, love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. I would propose to you this morning that the Great Commandment and the Great Commission are 2 parts of the seesaw, and that for ministry to have any sort of balance, to have ministry to have any sort of meaning, those 2 pieces belong together. Because you can't get to discipling all nations if you don't love the person you're discipling. Just can't happen. Nor can you just love a neighbor and say, you know what, I love you, I love you, I love you, but this isn't informed at all by Jesus. No, the reason we love the neighbor is because Jesus tells us to do so. Not because there's anything particularly special about love, but rather this is Jesus' command. You have to do both. Together. You have to love the neighbor, you have to love God, and you have to disciple the neighbor. Those 2 things belong together. A while back, a college campus ministry went to spring break in, I think it was Daytona Beach, or it might have been Miami Beach, it was someplace in Florida, and they did this for years. They rented out a hall in a hotel that was right on the beach. They rented out one of the rooms, one of the halls, and they served a free breakfast for the spring breakers, okay? And they would serve pancakes to any college student who came in, no matter what. And then they would evangelize these partying students, and it was a multi-year effort. And this college campus ministry spent major amounts of money on this project. And they got somebody new into the college campus ministry who was a numbers cruncher. And they realized that this ministry failed to show any kind of results that they thought they should. The college students were not more Christian after their interaction with the group of people. The college students did not follow up. There was no particular change or desire for people to become Christian. And since this was their point, they were trying to disciple college students, they said, we got to fix this. We got to figure out what's wrong. So one year, they asked why. They went to and found some folks and said, why didn't this work for you? Why wasn't this the transforming event or experience that we thought it should be? We put all this effort into this, and this did not lead us to more baptisms, to more visits to campus ministries back home. And the answers that they got were primarily in one category. And the answer was this. Your ministry is more concerned with how many people you fed this morning and how many prayers you could say with us than really wanting to love us and deal with our problems. The smile that you greeted me with when I went through the line and you gave me eggs and pancakes disappeared when I told your evangelist that I'm gay. Your evangelist could not wait to get to inviting the next guy in line for pancakes once I told him that I think I'm an alcoholic and I think that this spring break was a huge problem. I shouldn't have come here today. I'm desperately lonely. No one here in this room of 300 people would love me long enough or deeply enough to take my call of desperation at 3 a.m. Pancakes are fine, but where is the love? If anything, making disciples teaches us that it's hard work. It's going to disrupt your sleep. It's going to disrupt your circle of friends. And Jesus really meant it when he said that you have to love the person who is the polar opposite of you on the political spectrum with the same energy and enthusiasm with which you love your family, with which you love yourself. Is it any wonder that we pluck this verse out of our mental Bible? Because this is hard stuff. And it's certainly harder to do this verse than it is to recite from memory the 23rd Psalm. But I will tell you this. If you are open to the risen Jesus, the last part of the Great Commission, where Jesus says, I am with you always until the end of the age, if you really take that to heart, you will never be tentative or homesick again. That if you really take that verse to heart, the rest of the verses of the Great Commission and the Great Commandment all fall into place. You will find the risen Christ all over this world if you truly believe that Jesus is with us until the end of the age. It was this verse, this very verse, that allowed me to feel at home in the backyard barbecue of a bishop of the Evangelical Church in East Germany, Berlin. I've seen this verse painted on the dining hall of a community center which used to be a plantation in the deep south. Only yards from where we were eating, American slaves were horribly abused, and here we were, black and white together, eating and praying and worshiping and working together to love and to make disciples. On ground that had been so horribly used and misused. This verse is the one that made me feel at home in the United Kingdom, in Leeds, when I worshiped with the very elderly vicar and his wife, who at the end of worship, there were only maybe five people in the church, and it was falling down. It was one of these old, gigantic stone churches, and there were leaking parts in the ceiling. You could see where the water damage was. And at the end of the service, it was all done out of the Book of Common Prayer, and this elderly vicar's wife came out with a squeaky cart at the end. It was just like something out of a movie someplace, and she had tea and cookies for us. And I said, you know what? This is not really the worship that fits for me. This isn't really my style of doing things. But you know what? This vicar and his wife and the five people in worship, they're my brothers and sisters because Jesus commands it so. And he was there too. This verse is the one that accompanied me, and the risen Christ accompanied me past anti-Christian protesters in Kansas City, Missouri, where I attended the UCC's national meeting about 15 years ago. They, the protesters, as much as I despised their message and knew that they wanted to get a rise out of us to somehow prove that Christians aren't as sweet as everybody says they are, that Christians can be pushed to a point where they won't turn the other cheek, I knew that they too could not make me disavow Jesus' love for them or his presence on a hot Missouri afternoon. So I say to you this morning, go in the name of the risen Christ and love with all the extravagance that you can muster. Make disciples. Teach what you can, not what you can't. Humbly admit what you can't teach, what you don't know the answer to. Admit where you're wrong. Look for the risen Christ.
in the baptized, in the hungry, in the seeker, in the addict, in the atheist, in the secular. Put this verse back into your mental Bible, because wherever you find yourself, wherever you go, Jesus is there. And indeed, Jesus has promised to be with us always until the end of the age. Amen.